Marvellous.
Technology works that way.
Well, in common with all the other speakers, I'd like to say thank you to the organisers for inviting me to talk here today and for putting on an excellent programme. I was talking earlier to Bob, and I'm tempted to kind of say, well, everybody else has said this, so thank you and goodbye. But I will try over the next 20 minutes or so to tell you a little bit about the work that we've been doing at Acceleron in order to try and provide human clinical data at the earliest possible time in the development process, such that we can better inform the decisions that we're making about which drugs we do and don't take forward in the process. I'll spend a little bit of time just talking about the technology itself. I guess probably most people know what I'm talking about, but just in case there's a few people who've not seen our big machine at York, I'll include a picture of that. I'm then going to talk about three applications of the technology. One of the things that Acceleron is keen to dispel it to a certain extent is the fact that we are a microdosing company. We do a lot of microdosing, but we also do a lot of other stuff, probably around about 50-50 microdosing. I'll try and explain what the difference is between microdosing and the other applications. So, how does AMS fit into the drug development process? We've seen this kind of slide previously today. There's obviously a period of drug discovery, development, from when you get a new molecule to when it actually gets onto the market. And during that remaining time of its patent, you have an opportunity to recoup the cost. And anything we can do to pull that time to market forward is obviously valuable from the point of view of the drug company doing the developing. And with AMS, as I said before, what we're trying to do is give you clinical data, relevant human clinical data, as early as possible to try and help you to make better decisions in the development phase and try and cut that time to market so that there's additional time to recoup your investment. As has already been said today, the earlier we can kill bad compounds, the better, because it costs less. And also, if we can do something about selecting better compounds up front, that too is going to speed the process. Where does AMS Synarsys fit into the scheme of things? Microdosing, or human phase zero, is, as I say, an obvious one that is typically associated with Acceleron. But we also do a lot of work in early phase one. As you'll see, one application is by adding a tracer to a pre-planned phase one study, a normal phase one study. You get a lot of extra information, and you can also get additional information about intravenous pharmacokinetics and specifically bioavailability by adding a microtracer dose. We can also get involved in later stage studies, things like patient population studies, but I'm not actually going to talk about any of those applications today. So what is accelerator mass spectrometry? And please don't ask me any questions about this, because I'm not a nuclear physicist. But it was first described in the late 70s or mid 70s, and it was devised as a technique for measuring carbon-14 in order to carry out radiocarbon dating of artifacts from archaeological artifacts. There are something like 70 AMS facilities worldwide, but the vast majority of those are still doing the kinds of things which the technique was invented for. It wasn't until 1989 that the first biological application of the technique was reported from the Lawrence Livermore National Laboratory in the States. And since 1997, Acceleron been working up in York, developing the use of this technique in the biomedical research field. And as you can see, we've worked with a large number of molecules now, more than 160 at the last count. AMS is a tracer technique, and some may view that as something of a limitation. It does require a compound labelled with a rare isotope. It doesn't have to be carbon-14 because we're not measuring the radioactivity of the compound, but inevitably, because drug development develops carbon-14 labelled drugs, uses them and is comfortable with them, that's essentially all that we look at, with carbon-14 labelled drugs. In common with any other tracer technique, we make an assumption, obviously, that the labelled drug will behave exactly like the non-labelled analogue, and then we just follow the isotope and relate that back to drug concentrations. Essentially, you can do with AMS anything that you can do with a scintillation counter. Any of the traditional studies that you'll be familiar with in drug development, you can do with AMS. But because of the unique sensitivity of AMS, there are things that it facilitates, and in particular, the ability to do things earlier and in some cases, more simply. The reason for the sensitivity is in the basis of the detection. For a scintillation counter, you're actually looking, obviously, at the radiolabel, the decay of the radiolabeled isotope. And if I press the button, that worked well. It takes about a billion carbon-14 atoms to get one disintegration per minute. On the other hand, with AMS, we're actually physically separating out the carbon-12, 13, and 14 atoms, and we can make a valid measurement on just 1,000 14C atoms. So you can see there's a huge differential in terms of sensitivity. I'll go through this quite quickly, but essentially, in order to make the AMS measurement, we have to convert the biological sample into carbon. So that involves a three-day manual process of combusting and then reducing the carbon dioxide that's formed back to carbon. But suffice to say, most of our clients talk to us about why shouldn't we be automating this process. So far, all the progress that's been made in terms of automating it has come up with things that will do perhaps 10 samples in a day. We can manage 4,000 to 4,500 samples a month, so we wouldn't want to go backwards into an automated system at this point. That is a picture, as I promised, of the big machine that we've had at York for the last 11 years. I won't go through the various parts of it in the interest of time, but just suffice to say we have this year installed our second machine, and they're getting smaller. So I guess that's a room instead of a tennis court. Maybe in another 10 years we'll have a benchtop instrument, and probably all the pharmaceutical industry, hopefully all the pharmaceutical companies will have one in their laboratory, and we'll be consulting on it. Okay, I said that I was going to talk about microdosing, but that's not all that we do, and I'd like to try and illustrate that with this slide. If you think of a continuum total drug dose here, from a very low dose up to a higher dose, and similarly with radioactivity, a very low radioactive dose to a higher radioactive dose there. In the upper right-hand quadrant there, we have a high radioactive dose, high drug dose, and that's a conventional radiolabel study done with a scintillation counter. Microdosing, on the other hand, fits down in the bottom left-hand corner. We have a low radioactive dose, and we also have a low dose of drug, microdose. But increasingly, we get involved in work in this bottom right-hand corner, where we're still giving a very low amount of radioactivity, but we're actually giving a therapeutically relevant dose of drug. And in that way, you can get all the good metabolism data that you would normally get from a human radiolabel study. We coined the term meta-ID to cover that. The other area that I'm going to talk about today is absolute bioavailability studies. And this is an interesting hybrid between the two, the microdose and the tracer, nano-tracer techniques, if you like, in that you give a therapeutic dose of non-radiolabeled material at the same time as a microdose by the IV route of radiolabeled material, and you can measure them simultaneously by two different techniques. I will talk about that for a little while. Okay, microdosing. What is a microdose? Well, it's defined as 1/100th of the pharmacological dose, if that's known, Obviously, if you don't know the pharmacological dose, one would need to work something out based on human in vitro data and what you would predict your first in man dose would be and a suitable margin below that. But there's a maximum of 100 micrograms. However, a lot of the work that we do is on much lower doses than that, and I'll show some data in a moment where we've been giving single microgram doses and even sub-microgram doses. Because of the very low dose of mass of material, then there's minimal preclinical safety data required. And because of the very low radioactive dose, then in regulatory terms, these are non-radioactive studies. So you don't need to do animal dosimetry in the same way that you do for a conventional study. However, microdosing doesn't give you efficacy or safety data because it is, by definition, below the levels where you would see that. What it does give you, on the other hand, is human PK data at the earliest opportunity, and the intention is to facilitate better decision-making. And the question everybody asks, and I've been asked it two or three times today, is a microdose predictive of the pharmacological dose? It's a very good question. Some years ago, in order to try and answer this question, Acceleron were instrumental in setting up the CREAM trial, consortium for resourcing and evaluating AMS microdosing. And that study was designed to try and answer the question, with microdosing, would we have made better decisions in terms of go, no-go, in terms of developing specific drugs where we knew what the pharmacological pharmacokinetics were like. And five compounds were studied, which were chosen to represent potentially problematic situations, the sort of things which people say, oh, well, if it's a transporter, if uptake is transporter-mediated, microdosing won't work, will it? Well, maybe not. Maybe it will, maybe it won't. The data from the CREAM trial were published in 2006, and they're included in this table here. This was actually taken from a review document which has been written by my colleague Graham Lappin, and which will be hopefully published in the not too distant future. He reviewed the literature as a whole and found a total of 18 compounds where microdosing data were available and pharmacological data were available, and he compared those to see, well, is there a linear response? And essentially, as you can see from here, most of the drugs here are linear over a quite substantial range. There are, in fact, just three out of the 18 where there was some non-linearity. This compound here, the AUC was non-linear. In fact, Cmax was actually linear over the entire dose range. And the non-linearity in that case was actually at the very top, between the two highest doses, not between the lowest and the mid dose. Metoprolol, three up on the from the bottom on the right there, there was some non-linearity, but looking at the data, in fact, the LCMS assay that had been used to determine plasma concentrations in that study was basically below limit of quantification at the lower dose route. So again, there's some debate as to how valid those data are. Warfarin, one of the CREAM trial drugs, there was a clear non-linearity there in terms of distribution, and this has been attributed to the presence of a high affinity, low capacity binding site, which is obviously saturated at the pharmacological dose, but not at the microdose. So, 15 out of 18 drugs scaled. We've also been involved recently in the European Union Microdose AMS Partnership Programme, UMAP. Seven more drugs were chosen for study, following on from CREAM. Again, for reasons that these might be kind of drugs that wouldn't scale from a microdose. Publication of the results, I mean, the provisional data have been released, but publication results is expected. Perhaps that should be early 2009 now, but hopefully in the not-too-distant future. But I can say that there's generally been good agreement between the microdose data and the literature values. Obviously, at Acceleron, we've done a lot of microdosing studies at least 50 compounds now we've done pure microdose studies on. Unfortunately, few of those have gone on to be administered at the therapeutic dose, and even when they have done, clients don't always share their data with us. Obviously, a lot of the studies we do maybe 3 to 5 studies that we do for a compound selection type exercise, and clearly if we're successful, then 2 out of the 3 will never go on to do a therapeutic dose. So for various reasons, the comparative data from our own studies are sparse. However, where we do have it, including the data I've already shown us, the UMAP data and what we do know from in-house data, more than 80% of the cases that we're aware of are predictable between microdose and therapeutic dose. In comparison to that, this is an example of some, I guess it wasn't chosen because it was a good example, but it's human bioavailability against animal bioavailability. There's a correlation there, I suppose, maybe, I don't know. I think it's already been said today, but perhaps that would be a better option. So I guess what I would say in summary about predictiveness of microdosing, it's a tool. You need to use it with other data, and we're certainly looking at that kind of multi-faceted approach. But you need to compare it with what else is out there, and I think it's at least as good as some of the alternatives. Very quickly then, bearing in mind the time, an example of microdosing. This was a study where, I say, it was one of these candidate selection studies. We had 3 different drugs, and essentially we were able to dose each at a microdose and see that there was a definable difference in terms of the plasma concentrations after an IV dose that we could measure. And the conclusions from the study were essentially that compound B had a significantly higher bioavailability and absorption than the other two, and was chosen to go forward into phase 1. And as was mentioned in a couple of talks ago, the client's comment was, well, we wouldn't have chosen that drug without the microdosing data. So it is being used in a real sense by people out there. I guess you'd be aware of the FDA in February this year brought out the guidance for industry on safety testing of drug metabolites. And subsequently, there's been an awful lot of interest in whether AMS can be used to produce information on human metabolism as early as a possible stage in this process, such that we can avoid surprises later on in the piece. Okay, so the kind of studies that we're talking about then is if we have a human phase 1 study where we would give our drug, we would take some blood samples and we'd measure some plasma levels using LC-MS. And we still do all that, but what we do is we add a micro tracer, so about 200 nanocuries of radioactivity. It's below the kind of threshold that needs dosimetry, so you don't have to do any of that. But you can add it to an existing single ascending dose study design. So you can therefore immediately get total carbon-14, total drug-related material from your plasma samples. And if you collect urine and faeces, you can also get mass balance data, rotes and rates of excretion, and then you can do some metabolite profiling to find out the pattern of radiolabeled metabolites, and you can go on to do metabolite identification. So you can get all that data, single ascending dose study, instead of at the end of phase 1, early phase 2, or whenever it would be available. And it's all in human, target species. Just as an illustration, you will get, from that kind of study, you'll get total carbon-14 measurements. So that's everything which is drug-related circulating in the plasma. That's measured, obviously, by AMS. Using your parent drug is measured by an LC-MS method. You may have some specific metabolites that you know about, known metabolites. But in this example here, there's still a gap. There's some unknown metabolites. And what you want to know is well, are any of those within the the remit of the FDA guidelines, the MIST guidelines, i.e. is it more than 10% of the parent exposure. Simply doing HPLC separation and fraction collecting in a typical way, but using AMS as your detection technique, will give you a profile of metabolites in the same way as a traditional radiolabel study would be. This happens to be one where clearly there's a single metabolite, which is a lot more than 10% apparent. And that was obtained by injecting just one DPM onto the column in comparison to sort of hundreds of thousands that you would require for an equivalent traditional study. And similarly, you can get data from urine, feces extracts. So all the data that you can get from a conventional study at the earliest possible stage. Indeed, these kind of studies can be used to completely replace any need for a separate regulatory human AME study. And what it can be used for things like confirming the relevance of the safety tox species, making sure that you haven't got any human-specific or disproportionate metabolites, and simply answering the question, is man a rat or a dog or a monkey? Absolute bioavailability studies, then. As I mentioned before, this is kind of a hybrid between a microdose and a meta-ID study. Absolute bioavailability, conventional approach. You do an oral dose, take samples, measure those by LCMS. Second dosing stage, and you do an IV dose and you measure them in the same way. With the AMS approach, what we will do is we will give our oral non-radiolabeled dose, and either at the same time or more usually by infusion to coincide with the Cmax by the oral route, we'll introduce a microdose of carbon-14 labeled dose drug. And then what we'll do, we'll measure the amount of drug arising from the oral dose using the standard LCMS methodology, and then in the very same samples we'll measure another aliquot by AMS to get the amount of parent drug resulting from the IV dose. So you've got both bits of information in one sample. You can obviously also get total carbon-14 data as well. So what are the advantages of doing that? Well, there's no dosimetry required. Don't need the IV tox because that's covered. The dose that you're giving it at is the exposure that is obtained from that is covered by your oral toxicology. It minimises any IV formulation issues that you might have in terms of stuff is brick dust, but I can get enough in solution to give a few micrograms. And there are time and cost savings because you've only got one administration, you're collecting one set of samples and just splitting them instead of collecting two sets of samples. And it's scientifically, it's an optimal design as well. There's no temporal effects to consider, same subject, same day, dosed at the same time. And there's no dose-dependent kinetics because the body is handling the IV dose, albeit a microdose, in exactly the same way as the oral dose, which is in the system at the same time. It has to be because the enzymes are seeing exactly the same concentration. So there are absolutely no dose-dependent kinetic effects to worry about. And just to show you that it works, this is some data that was generated at Acceleron for midazolam, obviously a well-known drug, and the bioavailability data there are exactly what one would expect. And this is just an example of a study that was done at Acceleron where it was used in by the client to try and optimise the bioavailability of the candidate they were going to take forward for development. So candidate one, bioavailability of about 10%. Client didn't like that, so we did candidate two and got a bioavailability of about 60%. Which actually seems pretty good to me, but they weren't content with that, so they went on to candidate drug 3 and got a bioavailability of 80%. So this is all data that's generated very early on in the sort of clinical phase, and they've got a really good handle on getting a drug that meets the parameters that you've decided are appropriate for your drug. So if you want a drug that's incredibly bioavailable, I guess you wouldn't want one that isn't, but anyway. Just as just to finish off with the last couple of minutes, I mentioned there that you were giving the microdose by the IV route, and it's increasingly something that we find clients are very interested in. Is this may be the only way that you can get intravenous data on your drug. Why would you want intravenous data on a drug that's going to be given orally? Well, it gives you a lot of basic fundamental information about how the body is handling the drug. It can tell you things like, have you got first-pass metabolism going on? And you can do things like, if you collect feces, you can find out whether you've got biliary excretion as a significant route of elimination in man. And essentially, what it allows you to do is to understand whether the overall pharmacokinetics that you're seeing are being driven by things like absorption, or whether it's systemic metabolism and elimination. Essentially, having that IV data enables you to deconvolute the PK profile and have a much better understanding of how your drug is being handled by the body. So just to summarise then, decisions on which candidate drugs to develop have traditionally been based on preclinical data from animal species. We've all said today, it's been said many times, that the poor predictivity of those models can lead to wrong decisions. And the later the mistakes are realised, the more it costs to put them right or to go back to the drawing board. And as has also been mentioned earlier today, perfectly good drugs could be missed because they have poor PK properties in the rat that have actually brilliant PK properties in human. AMS, the kind of studies that we do with it aren't exactly rocket science in the kind of things that they do, but what it enables you to do, because of the sensitivity and because of the very small sample sizes that we need, it enables you to get human data at a much earlier date in the process, and so hopefully you can make better decisions earlier. And again, this is the beauty of going last, as has been said a number of times today, we have lots of tools in the toolbox, and I don't think anybody is advocating that any one probably of the techniques that we've talked about today is going to completely replace all the others and become the main, the only thing we do. But I think also we're pretty much agreed that the best model for man is man. And AMS provides some early human clinical data, well, really as early as it can. So it's another valuable tool in the toolbox. And with that, thank you for attention, and try and answer any questions.